I planned to give an extremely casual talk about the central experiment to a group of people who are sort of thinking about issues of mechanism of the coup rates, and I hadn't realized that these would be broadcast on the web, so in case in case anybody is actually downloading this from the web, this is at a very preliminary stage of the work, so if you have any comments or suggestions and definitely corrections, please feel free to send me an email. It's kmoler at leland.stanford.edu.
Why
were
you
focused
on the
practice? No, that's the panda. Hi, Mom. Okay, so just to quickly review a lot of what we heard about at the conference 2 weeks ago, there's a distinct possibility of spin charge separation in the coup rate superconductors, and as an experimentalist, spin charge separation seems like a fairly sharp concept to me, but that's because I don't have to calculate anything. The basic idea is that the electron...
You're ready to be a theorist,
then. The basic idea is that the electron, which carries charge E and spin a half and it's a fermion, breaks up into, and I guess that's where the question comes up whether it's theoretically sharp or not, into a charge-on or a hole-on, which carries charge E and spin zero and it's a boson, and a spin-on, which carries charge zero and spin a half and it's a fermion. And then in the version of spin charge separation that Central and Fisher have recently written a number of papers about, when they make this change of variables, there's this V2 gauge field that you get, and the Z2 gauge fields can have topological defects, and those topological defects are called bisons, and Central and Matthew are here to answer any questions about that. So the main point about a bison, or the way that I think of a bison, since I can't actually see bisons or detect bisons, I think of a bison as something that introduces a phase change of pi when a charge-on or a spin-on goes around it. And so it's intimately tied to the issue of flux quantization, and Central and Fisher proposed this experiment to detect bisons. The basic idea of the experiment, and this is actually Central's view graph from the conference 2 weeks ago, is that you trap a single vortex in a cylinder of a superconducting material, move it into the normal state, turn the field down to zero, and you have no more vortex. In fact, you had no more vortex as soon as you moved into the normal state, but you still have a bison trapped in the hole, and you move back into the superconducting state, and the trapped bison nucleates an HC over 2E flux. So what I'd like to do is tell you some of our ideas about how to actually carry out this experiment, although I think the experiment, the way that it was proposed, is a fairly clean proposal, and we're mostly going to follow that proposal. But I'd also like to talk about a lot of related experimental issues which I don't think have been satisfactorily addressed experimentally in the underdoped coup rates. And again, this is a case where if anybody's actually watching this on the web and you want to correct me, please please do let me know. Okay, so I think the main point of this talk is that these issues have not been addressed satisfactorily experimentally in the underdoped coup rates. We can address them experimentally, and we plan to address them on a time scale of months to possibly a year or two. And therefore, the course of the rest of this workshop is a great time for theorists to be creative in working out what's going to happen with single vortex and flux quantization behavior in the underdoped coup rate regime. So some of the questions that we'd like to address are, can a bison be detected in the underdoped coup rates, which is the question that Central and Fisher were working to address. In thinking about how to do this experiment, we realized that we would like to know how single vortices are pinned. The experiment basically requires that a bison be pinned when you go above TC, but in fact, not that much is known about how a single vortex is pinned as you approach TC, except in the optimally doped coup rates. You also want to know what is the flux quantum. If you trap a single vortex in the underdoped coup rates, is it in fact going to be an HC over 2E vortex? And this is something that I've always assumed was well established experimentally until I started looking through the literature, trying to find references associated with the experiment to test this theory. And actually, what is a phase diagram, and particularly, what does a phase diagram really look like in the underdoped cuprates? We still have this sketch that Patrick drew from in the theory talk, and you know, Patrick started out with a line here and then moved it over here and said, that's allowed, and everybody laughed. But in fact, it is allowed. It's actually perfectly consistent with, I would say, the if you want to have the same phase diagram in all of the cuprates, I think it's perfectly fair to do that in the context of the available experimental data. Okay, so in order to address these issues, we need good samples, and we also need ways to measure flux quantization and local magnetic field, and depending on how many questions I get, I may or may not have time, or suggestions too, I may or may not have time at the end of this to talk about our mesoscopic magnetism toolbox. Okay, I'll resist the urge to give the website address. but basically, the point is that we're developing at Stanford, and in collaboration with people at IBM, we're developing a variety of tools to measure magnetic fields on length scales that are small compared to sample size and large compared to the size of an atom. And superconductors, of course, are the classic example of materials that have interesting magnetic behavior on these intermediate length scales. And what we're doing is putting together a toolbox such that we can measure whatever needs to be measured magnetically in this intermediate length scale regime. Okay. Let me both give an example of how the mesoscopic magnetism toolbox is useful and talk about one of the earlier predictions that came originally, in fact, out of spin charge separation. And this was the prediction by Anderson, Chakravarty, and co-workers that the superconductivity in the cuprates might be driven by interlayer coupling. So they had the idea that because there's fractionalization in the plane, it's difficult for an electron to tunnel between the planes of the cuprate superconductors. But when the electrons form Cooper pairs, it's not difficult for the Cooper pairs to tunnel between the electrons of the superconductors. And they, in fact, proposed specifically that when the material went superconducting and the Cooper pairs were free to move along the C-axis, that saved C-axis kinetic energy might provide the condensation energy that's needed to drive the material superconducting. And Phil Anderson pointed out that this idea is consistent with what was known about the coupling between the layers in lanthanum, strontium, copper oxide, and then Tony Leggett sharpened that up into this experimental prediction where he introduced this parameter eta, which is a fraction of condensation energy that comes from the C-axis kinetic energy savings. So you can calculate this parameter lambda ILT from the measured condensation energy, and if all of the condensation energy in the material is provided by the saved C-axis kinetic energy, then the measured C-axis penetration depth should be equal to this calculated length, lambda ILT. And Phil Anderson put these three values for these three materials in a, I think it was a 1998 science paper, 1 micron in thallium 2201, 1 micron in mercury 1201, and 3 microns in lanthanum, strontium, copper oxide. The reason why these three materials are particularly useful to test is because they're single-layer cuprate materials with a high TC. And if you wanted to test these ideas in a material that had two copper oxide planes per unit cell, you could worry that experimentally you would measure the coupling between the bilayers, whereas theoretically it might be the coupling within the bilayers that's driving the material superconducting. So it's just cleaner to make the measurements on a single-layer material. So what we did is, in order to measure the C-axis penetration depth, we got single crystals of these substances and just simply image the vortices that were parallel to the planes in these materials. And we made these images with a scanning squid microscope at IBM. So these are our results in thallium 2201. This is what the pickup loop looks like. So what I'm doing here is we're taking this pickup loop and we're scanning it across the surface of the material, and we plot the total magnetic flux through the pickup loop as a function of, as we scan the pickup loop back and forth in X and Y across the material. And so what that tells you is that tells you the local magnetic field perpendicular to the surface of the sample convolved with the shape of the squid pickup loop. This is what resolution-limited vortices look like. This is the 10-micron scale bar. This is what interlayered Josephson vortices look like in thallium 2201. And you can see that the size of them is tens of microns, and that tells you immediately that the C-axis penetration depth is tens of microns, even without doing any modeling. And then if you do more careful modeling, you find out that the C-axis penetration depth in these materials is actually 18 microns.
Can you measure the total flux?
In these, they're getting a little bit big. In general, when we measure, if we measure total flux in a resolution-limited vortex, we put sort of 20% systematic error bars on it. There's two ways to do it. One way is to fit these images, assuming that we know the shape of our squid pickup loop very well. And the other way to do it is to simply integrate up the total flux inside that image. And the first one has systematic errors associated with the fact that there are leads to the squid pickup loop and we have to model them. And the second one has systematic errors associated with the fact that there's not a total, you know, the sample has some shape and the flux lines are returning in some way. And so when we do the integral, there's some background that comes from any residual background field in neighboring vortices, so we have to do a background subtraction. So we can't do better than 20% on those. And then on these, because they're bigger, both of those problems get more dramatic.
There's a difference between 1 or 2.5, right?
In these vortices, we can tell the differences between 1 and 2. In this vortex, we can probably tell the difference between 1 or 2. It looks nicer with 1, but we didn't analyze them arbitrarily carefully for that. And if it were really, really crucial, we would want to go back and do the measurement over again with more careful attention paid to background issues. Okay. So we did some checks to see if we're measuring the right penetration depth. And we also made measurements in Mercury 1201, where we found a C-axis penetration depth of 8 microns in comparison to the prediction of 1 micron. And so at the end, and we also measured lanthanum, strontium, copper oxide. And now we're getting into the regime where we can tell how much flux the vortices carry much more reasonably, because the vortices are much more compact without taking a lot of trouble over background issues. Okay, so the theoretical prediction was that lambda C needed to be about 1 micron in thallium 2201 and mercury 1201, which are the two highest TC single layer materials. And the experimental result is that only about 1% of the condensation energy could be provided by the interlayer tunneling model in nominally optimally dense samples of these two materials. And I want to emphasize that because I think it's a really important caveat. We made these measurements on the highest quality, optimally doped samples that we could find, but they're still different samples than the samples that the condensation energy measurements were made on. Now, I mean, that doesn't bother Phil Anderson because he says that he can calculate the condensation energy and it agrees with the measured, his estimates from TC agree with the measured condensation energy, but simply as an experimental point of view, if you really wanted to be, you know, really exquisitely careful about this, you would want to measure the condensation energy and the interlayer C-axis penetration depth on the same materials, and you would want to do it systematically as a function of doping all the way across this whole phase diagram. And we simply cannot do that because we simply do not have samples available to do that. Okay, so moving forward, let me address the issue of spin charge separation and flux quantization. So when you have this spin charge separation, you break your electron up into something that carries charge E, which is a boson, and something that carries spin and a half, which is a fermion. And you can imagine that if you have these charge E bosons, you might just get a condensation of charge E bosons, but at least I can imagine that because I'm an experimentalist, so I don't have to worry about whether I can prove it theoretically or not. And there were a number of papers in the early days, theoretical papers, addressing the issue of flux quantization in of whether or not this kind of flux quantization would lead to HC over 2E or HC over EE vortices. And I would say that to briefly summarize these are just a couple. I believe there's more theoretical papers that I'm not citing. To summarize the theoretical situation, you could get HC over E vortices in some regimes, in some regions of the phase diagram, but depend on microscopic parameters that you don't necessarily know very well for particular materials, and depending on the time scales in which you make the measurement, and possibly depending on other dynamics issues. So the point is that theoretically, I think it's very much a possibility that you could get HC over E vortices in these materials. So, and I think that there's a general feeling that you don't have HC over E materials in these, materials. At least I always thought that you didn't, in fact, have HC over E vortices in the underdoped cuprates. So how do you know whether you have an HC over E vortex or an HC over 2E vortex if you don't have a scanning squid microscope, which we haven't had until very recently? So the classic way is the Stever-Fairbank experiment, where they took a cylinder of a conventional superconductor, I think it was 10, and they measured the total magnetic flux through this cylinder as a function of the applied magnetic field. And here they have a step, and here they have another step. This is a good early example of the value of lines drawn to guide the eye. but I think it's a pretty reasonable one. And they point out here that the quantized unit we find experimentally is not HC over E, but HC over 2E within experimental error. And it's a little bit of a digression, but actually, if I don't know how many of you have looked at this issue of Physical Review Letters. So there's actually four papers there, two experimental papers and two theory papers back to back. And what this is one experimental paper. The other experimental paper says that the flux appears to be quantized, but reports a 40%, the possibility of a 40% systematic experimental error because they didn't find HC over E. And then there are two theory papers pointing out that the fact that you find HC over 2E instead of HC over E is consistent with the idea that you have some pairing mechanism operating in the superconductivity. And it's really quite remarkable to me that, and these people were all next to each other down the same hallway. And if you picture the analogous experimental, situation today, I don't know how many experimentalists today would report HC over 2E and, you know, not comment, and, you know, have the self-restraint to not comment on it whatsoever and let theorists write a whole paper saying, oh, 2E could be pairs. It's kind of an interesting situation. Okay, so the next classic experiment is this experiment where here they're demonstrating fluxoid quantization instead of flux quantization, and what they're doing is now they're measuring the resistance of a cylinder, which is very close to TC, and they're changing the magnetic field through the cylinder. And as they change the magnetic field, TC oscillates back and forth, and so they see an oscillation in the resistance, which has a periodicity of a flux quantum. And in fact, this paper was, at the time, I believe, very much criticized. And there's several papers that cite this paper that are addressing issues of whether or not this measurement is right, given how disordered and granular the superconducting materials are. Okay, so that was 1962. So let's move forward to the classic experiment, Collin-Gauss experiment, published in Nature in 1987.
You might have other curves that show HC over 40 also. Those weren't published.
Oh, really?
Ronald Parks and Bill Little bringing them, Parks bringing them by. He was a graduate student when I was there. And they were very interesting. They were fine structure in what you just showed. In the sense, I don't think you can see them in what you showed, but they had other graphs where when you looked in and blew them up, you could see what they were wondering. Again, I don't think they let those out.
I see. So they never did. They ever resolve that issue?
It kind of gradually went away. There was a time when certainly Little and others, we were talking about whether you could have, you know, groups of four after paired. Was there any? Were there any correlation to that issue? I don't think there was, but the data was curious.
Oh. That's really fascinating. I have to go back in.
The paper you described is back and back with some of the people. Yang came out. Uh-huh. Was at Stanford. He flew out and was at Stanford during that period of two or three or four weeks when they were getting that data. Of course, he had a great rush
to fly the data back to get it published.
To get the paper flown back at that time out of Stanford.
It looked like there were just days between the submission dates of those different papers.
Weaver found that in about 2 days. They had a paper written. Uh-huh. Yang, what unifiers, the CDL, was working very hard on it. Because Fairbank knew that Hunsager had already said it would be two. Perhaps he hadn't explained why, but he had said it would be two. And Weaver, and those of us who talked about it, it was always thought this was two. So drawing those lines was completely what they wanted to do. Nobody wanted to draw an
to see over to me.
Was the point that our policy officer paper wasn't appreciated at the time?
Yeah, both ways. Depends who you ask. There were plenty of, there were other people, Schrieffer for one, who understood that what you said, Abercross and other things, okay? But not around Stanford, well. Abercross on paper is very difficult.
No, I just, it's a historical thing.
People at Stanford aren't that bright. Okay, so this is 1987 colon Gao. This is the classic demonstration of 8C over 2E flux quantization of the cuprate superconductors. And here they're ramping up the field, and basically what you see here are jumps. They have a sample which is a sintered powder ring which is millimeters in size. And they're measuring the flux through it. And these are jumps of sort of, I don't know, 100 or so flux quanta entering the sample at once. Then they put the squid in the center of the ring and they measure the noise. And as they measure the noise, they see these little jumps which are consistent with 8C over 2E vortices moving in and out of the sample. And so the main point that I want to make with this is that it was a beautiful, it was a beautiful experiment. And it's cited a lot. And the sample had a broad superconducting transition between 50 and 85 Kelvin, which would, in modern times, not be the kind of sample that you would want to use if you were going to make measurements characterizing the optimally doped, characterizing a particular value of the dopage. And so I looked in citations, and there's 150 papers that cite this paper. And I figured that one of those papers would be the paper that would show me the flux quantization in the underdoped state. And I read the abstract of all of them, and there were 10 of them that looked like they might have something to say about the flux quantization in the underdoped state, and all 10 of those were theory papers.
There
are people who sort of like bitter backgrounds.
Right, so there are bitter decoration measurements, and I think, so I wasn't able, there probably are, and again, I hope I'm going to get a phone call from somebody, not that anyone's listening, but maybe you even know the references. There probably are bitter decoration studies as a systematic function of doping on the samples that were available the last time that people were still worried about flux quantization. I think the thing about bitter decoration is that you can really only use bitter decoration. I don't know if this is a theoretically important point or not, but you can really only use bitter decoration to determine the flux quantization in a relatively high magnetic field, because you need to be sure of, you need to know what the magnetic field is in order to compare it to the density of vortices and determine the flux quantum. So I don't know if that's important. And then the other thing, of course, the issue that is completely clear is that hopefully this week I'll find that set of references, and that I'm sure that it's pretty old, and that the samples that were available then might not be as good as what's available now.
This scope, it acts like a stack of Josen junk, right? And from the field dependence of the data, they see this oscillatory pattern, right?
Right.
And don't they infer AC over 2E from that pattern as well?
Yeah, that's with the flux in a different orientation, though.
Exactly, it's in a Josephson orientation.
In the Josephson orientation. Yeah, that's a good point. With the field and plane. And how, do you know how systematically that's been done as a function of doping?
Well, I think they've only done it for one doping body. But in principle, people are doing these stacked experiments, these maze experiments now on the underdoped materials, right?
Yeah, there are some really beautiful results on those now.
Yeah.
Although only for slightly underdoped. I'm going to get to this point in a few slides, but if you want to sort of study this hump, that could be a good way to do that. Okay. So actually, John Kirtley and Chang Sui, when they did the tricrystal experiment showing half integer flux quantization, meaning 8C over 2E flux quantization in tricrystals, they also, incidentally, did sort of a repeat of the Deaver-Fairbanks experiment on a 50-micron ring of an optimally doped YBCO film, and now this one is 1994. And here they're ramping up the magnetic field, and you see steps in the, can I get it, flex in the center of the ring. And again, these steps are consistent with HC over 2E flex quantization. And this has been done on, this was on optimally doped YBCO.
Is it inner and outer radii or what? Sorry.
Yeah, so it's 50 micron diameter and the thickness was 10 microns. Okay. So I think that the theoretical prediction is pretty clear that at least HC over E is not totally ruled out by a theoretical consensus, if that's safe enough to say. Although in terms of actually saying what we would need to, what precisely as experimentalists we would need to do in order to see HC over E vortices, I think one theorist said it best, and he said the dynamics is hard. But I think experimentally, even though there aren't really sharp predictions for in what regimes and in which time scales we should look for HC over E vortices, the fact that we haven't ruled them out experimentally across the whole across the whole phase diagram is sufficient reason just to go and look for them, even if there were no relevant theoretical work being done whatsoever. So I mention this because this is the beginning of a theoretical workshop, and so if you'd like to have HC over E vortices, I think there's room for you to have them. Okay. So let's come back to the central experiment. So here you have this vison, and the vison is something that when a chargeon goes around it, the chargeon acquires a phase shift of pi, and therefore if you have a flux tube associated with the vison, the flux tube will carry flux HC over 2E and not HC over E. And so you want to look for this vison by basically trapping the vison, trapping the vortex in a hole, and moving into the normal state so that the vortex is gone, turning the field down to zero. The superconductor, in experimentalist language, the superconductor remembers that it had a vortex there. In theorist language, the superconductor has a vison trapped at the center of the hole. And then you go back in the superconducting state, and the vison wants to have HC over 2E flux, so a flux is regenerated when you go into the superconducting state. So the main experimental drawback in this issue, as Central pointed out, is how long does the vison stay trapped in the normal state, and how quickly can you make the measurement compared to how long the vison is going to stay trapped in the normal state. And again, you know, dynamics is hard. So ideally,
I'm sure there are a number of things trapped in there. Can you just do the experiment many times and have the time to get a number and have the
experiment? No, you would apply a different field. So at least in optimally doped superconductors, you can trap different number of vortices in something by having a different applied field.
Oh, okay.
Not with perfect control, but again, you can do it several times.
So that's under experimental control, okay.
Yeah, well, it's under experimental control to know how many you have trapped there. Let me put it that way.
But this prediction is unique no matter, to have anything trapped, isn't it? I mean, and if you didn't have spin charge separation, you don't expect anything trapped in the center.
Yeah, you need to make sure there are those straight fields.
Yeah, and in the absence of any.
I mean, if the thing is kind of granular or something like that, so you could still have a region of superconductor.
We can check for that.
So you're thinking in reverse direction or something.
To check
I'll show you
there.
That we can check for that.
If you reverse the direction, if the field comes back in the other direction.
Sure, well, that would be nice. But
if it's also the new direction, they come up with
other
ways to
measure. What do you mean?
No, the important part is that the flux quantum reappears here when you cool it in zero field. And so the point is
that the spontaneous creation of flux.
The spontaneous, well, I'm not sure I'd call it spontaneous because it depends on the history of the sample. It's not the ground state to have a vison and a flux there. It's a metastable state. So it appears to be spontaneously created when you cool back down. So in other words, if you warm up just a little bit above TC and you do it sufficiently quickly, whatever that means, you should see this effect. If you warm up to 400 Kelvin and cool back down again, then the vison would escape and you wouldn't see this effect. So that's actually a reasonable experimental check to do. And then also they proposed, I think the cleanest experimental check that you can do is to trap different number of vortices in the hole. And if you have two visons trapped in the hole, you should get no flux quantum. And if you have three visons trapped in the hole, you should again get one. And the one could have either a positive or negative sign. And if we saw that, I think it would be, you know, pretty convincing evidence for something that's somehow inducing a pi phase shift. I mean, it would be very surprising to have an effect that remembers that it has, that it's, to remember that you have a vortex is weird enough, but to remember that you have an odd number of vortices, but not how many odd vortices that you had, would be pretty, I mean, I think that set of tests would rule out all the experimental errors associated with stray fields and so on and so forth. And I think they would probably also rule out other theoretical ideas about how you could get this effect.
Wait, that last thing I want to get straight. You would rule out all the other theoretical ideas, like stripes and so on?
Well, no, wait. So, actually,
that's just one theory.
That's basically what I want to learn this week. Mm-hmm. Is what would and would not be ruled out.
I will say that you have unusual quantum moments.
So stripes could accommodate them or not?
Well, in the usual phase in which we think about them, mm-hmm. they will become stripes quantum numbers. We need to tell. Yeah. I mean, Jacob's equation is being charged for reasons that have to do with one dimensional physics, not due to the vortex.
Thanks, Tom.
And that would be.
But this has nothing to do with the H over E, right? That we talked about before.
Well, it has to do with the H over E because I think it has to do with the H over E because I, at least Subir Sachdev says that if you have spin charge separation, in addition to having this effect, you also have HC over E flux quantization in a narrow region, in a particular region of the phase diagram. And therefore, you should see both this effect and you should be able in some part of the phase diagram to see H over E.
In a completely different experiment.
In a completely different experiment.
What?
In a completely different experiment, right. So we'd like to search for H over E flux quanta basically by doing that experiment where you ramp, doing the experiment that I showed you before that John Kirtley did where you ramp the field and see HC over 2E vortices coming in. And in one of the one of Steve Kibbleson's papers, he says that if you ramp the field fast enough, you'll see H over E flux quantization instead of HC over 2E flux quantization. So that's one place where we'd like to look, although again, we don't know what ramp the field fast enough means. And then the other prediction is that in a very narrow slice of the phase diagram at high temperature in the underdoped samples, you should see HC over E flux quantization. So we'll just look for trapped vortices and see if they're HC over E or HC over 2E vortices.
In the
basic explanation is HC over 2E, but I guess the question that was being debated was raised was whether the lowest energy excitation is HC over E or HC over 2E.
Near TC, is that right? Is that just below TC?
Yeah, it's in a little slice over here, just below TC and for low doping. And then that slice can be determined by some microscopic parameters.
As I understand it, the HC over E comes out, at least in Subir's calculation, in the U1 gauge theory. So HC over E is not in any way a signature of your kind of topological
error. A signature of ignoring gauge fluctuation, which you make the theory, which you can only do if you are actually in a Z2 theory, in a deep inclined phase.
But also U1 theory with the charge took on this thing.
And you.
Yeah. Right, so that's the same Z2 physics.
So the claim is from the experts that if you see HC over E quantization near TC in an underdoped sample, that too is evidence for Z2 gauge theory.
Calculations wrong, isn't that right? Is that what you're implying?
No. Statement is that the memory of the HC over 2E is just supposed to be under the two gauge theory.
No, that I understand. That's very clear. But what is the status of the HC over E?
No, so my understanding is that there are two completely separate predictions that both come from ideas of spin charge separation. And then whether the realization of either of those experimental predictions has implications for various versions of spin charge separation and has various implications for how likely you are to see some of the other experimental predictions is something that I don't know, but it might be possible to sort it out.
In light of the fact that they've seen spontaneously created voltages, like in Emil's experiment and Gertrude's experiment, you're also looking for spontaneously created HC over 2 voltages here. You have to rule out the boring explanation that exists now for the...
Those are HC over 4 eaves. They were half of the...
Okay, so you rule out if it's HB over 4. You have to integrate to find exactly what the flux is.
I agree with you completely that in a high TC superconductor, especially in a poorly characterized sample, seeing spontaneously generated magnetic fields is not that surprising. Although it doesn't mean that you shouldn't try to figure out why you see them. But here we're talking about hopefully a pretty well-controlled geometry. Here we're hopefully talking about a single crystal, and we're talking about spontaneously generated HC over 2E, and we're talking about this even odd effect. And I think that even odd effect is going to be quite surprising if you see it. Okay, so if you trap one, so you trap 2n plus 1 times HC over 2e vortices, and after you cycle the normal state and back again, you see HC over 2e. If you trap 2n HC over 2e vortices, and you come back to the normal state, you see nothing. You see no vortices.
So you have to have enough time to measure the flux before you cycle the field, is it?
You start at very low temperature, and you can measure the flux in the initial state and in the final state, and you don't have to do it while you're changing the temperature or while you're changing the doping, although it would be nice if you could.
So if you make the sample, kind of large, why can't you make the escape time of this Wieser to be as large as you want?
Because I'm going to get to that. Let me get to that. Okay, so the vortex escapes on this time scale, which is related to T star and some geometrical factors. And because it escapes on a time scale which is related to T star, ideally you would like to do this experiment at T equals zero, and you would like to do it by tuning doping. But unfortunately, we really can't do that. Neither the T equals zero nor the clean tuning of doping in a single sample. And since we can't do either one of those things, we'll take a sample with a hopefully known doping and go back and forth across the phase boundary this way and hope that the dynamics works out for us to see the experiment. Okay, so what we want to do is we want to make the vortex escape time as long as possible so we can control the geometry of the sample, and that's sort of the purpose of the whole. And we can also try to get a sample that's very underdoped so that we can make T star as large as possible.
You just push it up the temperature very quickly, you expect some effect on this in a normal superconductor.
No, you wouldn't. Because in a normal superconductor, well, I'm going to...
If you just do it quickly back. And switch it back on, it doesn't probably have time to change. So.
No, because the relevant time scale goes to zero at TC in a conventional superconductor. Okay, that's quite correct, but we can... The point is that because we have... Because we have a scanning squid microscope, we can look for superconductors. We can look for superconductivity above what we think is TC. We can check that our sample is really normal. We can check that our sample has
a time scale for that.
Right, but we can do the experiment. We can do the experiment. We can do two separate experiments. One is we can sit here in zero field, and we can measure the local magnetic susceptibility of our sample and make sure that there's no diamagnetic grains in our sample. Okay, and that's something that it's something that I was planning to get to later on in the talk, so let me just say it now. So I think we can keep that under experimental control.
So you can better estimate the time that it takes for the magnetic field to penetrate the crystal once it goes normal. And at least improved estimate is that it would do it extremely fast for 10 to minus 5 seconds.
Much faster than 10 to the minus 5 seconds. The time scale goes...
Perhaps faster, but...
Yeah. I mean, as you approach TC, flux motion is extremely, extremely quick. I mean, people go to a lot of trouble. There's a whole conference going on right now in the Netherlands about vortex motion. And one of the things that people go to a lot of trouble to do is to try to make measurements faster so they can measure vortex dynamics closer to TC. And they can't get to TC, and just bringing you a little closer to TC is a real experimental achievement. So I'm just, that's, it's just not, I think that'll be okay.
So
No.
Okay.
I'm saying that it's possible for this to open on temperature, and of course it's difficult to move X continuously.
Right.
Are there any other techniques like, say, pressure or something like that to change?
Or gates in film?
Yeah, there's both pressure and gates, at least in principle. So pressure is something that is very hard to do in a scanning squid microscope, but it might be possible to devise another geometry in which it would be possible to do it. And the gates are, there are some measurements where people have made gated samples and changed carrier concentration by gating the sample. And I'd have to say that those samples are not sufficiently well characterized for making these kinds of measurements yet. I mean, and in fact, if you could make those samples, that would be really, really neat. There'd be a lot of really fun things to do with them.
Well, the whole point is that you don't need very good samples. This is topological.
Right. So as long as we can, then if we can do this, then we can do it with, you know, the crappy samples that we have. But the samples where people gate things. I mean, have you looked at this?
No.
Yeah, I don't think they're good enough even for this actually.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not, and also they're not that. I mean, you'd want to do it.
They were really good.
You'd want to do it.
Really thin films, just a few layers thick things directly.
No, you have to think of the penetration length to see whether the flux is actually tracked, right? I mean, although this 2D penetration length is huge, right? 2019, like, right?
Okay,
I'm the
so
square of a D. Yeah.
There's three layers thick.
Okay, so what we want to do is we want to trap a vortex and we want to not let the vortex escape. So I said that this was a progress report. We've only been working on this for a week since we got back from the conference, but and I thought we were making pretty fast progress until Doug told his story about Deaver and Fairbank doing that entire measurement and sending it off and writing the paper, sending it off to PRL in 2 weeks. And so
I should be careful. The measurement wasn't, but once they saw the effect.
Oh, seeing the effect. Oh, okay. Right. Okay. Anyway, so what we want to do is make sure that we have a hole so that we can know that the Vison is in the hole, and hopefully that'll put the Vison inside a deep potential well so it'll really stay there. And so basically, this will be our biggest sample, which will be each of these things is a millimeter. But this is a mask, and so the progress report is that we sent the mask off to be made. So we'll have a single crystal with the smallest hole that we can make in the center of it, just one hole. And then we don't know whether we'll be able to trap a single vortex in that hole or not. You know, we're in real danger of having like lots of trapped vortices on pinning defects in the sample.
You said single, it's like a YBCO?
Yeah, YBCO single. So we're going to try to do this on UBC samples.
How are you going
to
drill the hole?
We have two techniques for drilling the hole. Well, maybe three, but two that we're going to try off the bat. One of which is a citric acid etch that Doug Bond's been working on over the last couple months. And one of which is focused high and beam etching. Well, we don't know what the size of the hole is because we haven't made it yet. So I don't want to make any promises about what size hole we can make. But probably the citric acid etch, probably the wet etch will lead to a hole that's tens of microns and probably a millimeter crystal. And the focused ion beam, I just don't know how well we'll be able to do, but hopefully, you know, micron scale. But anyway, so we're worried, and we actually might make some bigger ones too, but you know, we want to make sure the Vison has to go across a lot of distance to get to the outside. So we have this is where we're hoping to do the experiment, and then we're also, you know, in this sort of geometry, which are rings whose inner diameters are 10, 20, 40, and 80 microns, in this kind of geometry, we know that we can trap one vortex in optimally doped YBCO, so that seems like a good kind of geometry to start trying to trap vortices in underdoped films. If we can get underdoped films, and in fact, although we've only been working on this particular experiment for a week, Doug Bond's been visiting Stanford, and we've been working on ways to pattern the YBCO single crystals on smaller length scales than what people typically pattern crystals on, so maybe we can do something. Okay.
Nothing is a film?
Well, films are typically thousands of angstroms thick.
Those are just all rings at the bottom, right?
Yeah, these are just all single rings.
They're not meant to be irregular or anything?
No, just single isolated rings. Yeah, they're only irregular because it's a GDS2 file and I had to convert it to a GIF file to show it. So. Okay. Okay, so the next point is that we have to not only put the vortex there, but we have to get it to sit at, how am I doing for time, actually? There's no clock in here.
I guess we started around 5 hours, so it's been about 45 minutes.
Okay, great. So what we want to do is not have the Vison escape. So if we measure in the very underdoped sample, then the time scale for the Vison to escape depends exponentially on T star over T. Unfortunately, it depends exponentially on, we were just talking about this morning, depends exponentially on T star over T times, you know, some numbers that depend on your model of Vison pinning and geometry and, you know, factors of order, you know, 10 or something. So
In the exponent, yeah.
And the naive expectation, it depends, so it depends, it really depends on what it is that you're relying on to pin the...
The concern is if you don't drill a hole and you just have a, you know, randomness in your film and you get vortices trapped somewhere, you don't gain the full condensation energy. You may gain a tenth of the condensation energy, something like that. And that's, that would go up in that exponential.
But the hole would just be T star over T.
T star over T times, so with a hole it's T star over T. Wait. So if it's a, with a hole, it's T star over T times some factors of order 1. And if you don't put a hole there, then it's T star over T times some completely unknown factors.
So why should it be T star? Some scale, but why should that be the Fresnel scale in particular? I mean, that's really maybe nice, but...
Well, irrespective of whether it's specifically T star, if the superconductor is coming from spin charge separation up here, then the Vison's going to already exist up here.
Yeah.
So there's some Vison condensation energy, which is larger than this energy scale.
Sure.
I mean, if it's T star or not.
If it's not sufficient there at all, then the T star, I mean, the experimentally observed T star is a lower bound for the Vison.
Yeah, it may be such a broad, you know, crossover, maybe 5 to 10 times or something like that.
Yeah, no, that's that. But we, if anything, it might be bigger than this T star.
If it's bigger than T star, we'll get a positive result in the experiment. So the important question about T star, I think, is in these geometrical factors, is if we get a negative result, are there any conditions under which a negative result would be meaningful? I think the size of the hole isn't important, although there may be, you know, Vison phase coherence length issues that I don't really know. What?
Why not just a regular superconducting ring?
Right, yeah, that's what we're, a regular superconducting ring, but that's what we're going to make, yeah.
But something like the thickness of the sample.
Oh, no, the small hole, well, okay.
If it does something like the thickness of the sample, then it's the same as the flavoring.
Yeah, the thickness of the sample comes in the exponent, actually. The important point here is that there are geometrical factors and sample quality factors which are sorry. I always want to do that to my freshmen, but they're paying so much tuition. The important point is that there are geometrical factors and sample quality factors that are in principle completely unknown, but you know, TC versus T star is a big difference in the exponents. So you want to measure as far in the very underdoped regime as you can. Okay. So that brings us to the issue of wanting to get very underdoped samples. Both so that the experiment has some hope of succeeding and so that the experiment has some hope of being, and so that the samples have some hope in being in the regime that's relevant to the theory. So I just want to show you, I actually spent pretty much the whole weekend in the library looking for measures of flux quantization in underdoped samples, and also looking for examples of magnetic and resistive transitions on underdoped samples that I could show to you and explain how our measurements and our samples are going to be better than those samples. And in fact, I didn't really even find any measurements that I could show you. there's really not very much. So let me show you, for example, this is a YBCO phase diagram. So this is a specific heat measurement on YBCO. This is John Loram's 1993 PRL. So this is their raw data for the difference in specific heat divided by temperature of their some sample minus the same quantity measured on a zinc doped sample where superconductivity is killed is a function of temperature up to 300 Kelvin. And so this is their raw data, and these big peaks that you see are the background that they have because the phonon-specific heat is changing as a function of oxygen doping. And then once they subtract the model for how the phonons are changing, this is their electronic-specific heat. And so what I want to show you is that, what I want to say is basically that if you look at this regime here, this is from 0 to 50 Kelvin right here, okay? And this is the peak in the specific heat from which the TC of this underdoped sample is being determined. And so this is like, you know, a 30 Kelvin sample, and it's a kind of a wide specific heat peak. And this is really some of the absolute best data that I could find. And so I'm not going to show you some of the worst data. And so this is TC as a function of X in YBCO 7 minus X. And so this is TC, and the lowest TC sample that they had in this paper was a 30 Kelvin, TC. Okay.
Where is that sample in the original data?
That's this sample right here.
So where is the hump?
Well, the hump is obscured by the background. And then after they subtract the background, the hump comes out.
Again, is it out of the question to try and use some of Bond's ortho 2?
No, it's not out of the question. That's an excellent idea. I'll do that last week.
Actually, I remember Boyd Veal in the old days could make samples all the way down to the anti-ferro magnet, and at least a transition list for ortho 2 Kelvin width transition list all the way down to the anti-ferro magnet.
Great. I really want to check out those references, so let me talk to you right afterwards. I'm sure that there is better data. There must be better data out there than what I found in the library. All I'm saying is that like what you typically see is disheartening. And I guess I want to hammer this point home also because, you know, we are completely dependent on having samples on which we can do the measurements, right? And it is not stylish to fund materials development efforts of superconducting samples in the underdoped regime, which are never going to be technologically useful for anything, just because it seems like an interesting theoretical question, right? And I think it's really, really important somehow to get that message back to people who do funding that, A, this is a really, really interesting question, and I know that theorists are all fighting really, really hard for funding yourselves, but, you know, that...
You know the answer to that.
I forgot about that. Mom, send money. But no, not to me. I mean, the people who make samples. Right? I think the issue of sample quality away from optimal doping is, you know, really, like, really the showstopper in this field. Okay. So here's a BISCO phase diagram. This is a phase diagram from photoemission where they're showing the superconducting peak ratio. And then here they have this background curve that everybody draws that shows TC as a function of doping. And you notice that the lowest temperature sample measure has a TC of about 30 Kelvin, and I think that's a dysprosium-doped BISCO film. I could not find any data in the literature. And again, you know, it may be out there, and I just couldn't find it, for clean resistive or magnetic transitions on BISCO single crystals below 50 Kelvin. So I think that support of this dysprosium doped work is really important. And in fact, Isaki told me that they have done what's necessary to grow very clean BISCO with oxygen doping below 50 Kelvin, and what happens is the samples just flake to pieces. Because if you've ever, you know, held a piece of BISCO, it's, you know, roughly you can think of it as like holding a piece of baklava, and you can think of, you know, deoxygenation as taking all the filling out of the baklava. So. And then there are measurements. You know, this is a very nice set of measurements deciding where the pseudo gap is in BISPO as a function of doping. And here they have, you know, very clean transitions, you know, as a function of doping around 60 to 90 Kelvin. And so usually when you see people showing very clean transitions when they're doing studies as a function of doping, they're usually pretty much working on that hump. And if they're going below, that in either BISPO or YBCO, and they show you a really clean magnetic transition or a really clean resistive transition, please call me and let me know, because I'd like to get their samples. Okay. So the third experimental challenge is vortex detection. And so now I'm pretty much done with the scientific part of my talk. So this is sort of a word from our sponsor about how we know how to detect vortices. So we have this mesoscopic magnetics toolbox. And the first tool in the toolbox is a scanning squid microscope. We actually were planning to do studies. We had not planning precisely, but we had thought about doing studies of single vortex pinning and superconductors. And after we realized how little is done in the underdoped crystal, it seemed like a really good idea to go and do that. So actually, even if Sentinel and Fisher told me right now that, you know, in fact, they made a mistake and bisons couldn't possibly exist, we would still do the complete set of experiments that we're thinking of doing to test for bisons, because, you know, they simply really need to be done in the underdoped samples. So anyway, we went back, and Janice Nguyen got an ortho, that's my student, got an ortho 2 crystal from Doug Bond and put it in the microscope and looked at vortices, and they look pretty much like HC over 2E vortices, although we'll try to make that statement more quantitatively sharp as time goes on. And we tried to push them around and tried to look for them moving, tried to see if we could see them move at 3 Kelvin or 7 Kelvin, which we can't see vortices in optimally doped YBCO don't move at those temperatures. John Kirtley has shown that they don't move up until you get to about 0.92 C in the dilute single vortex pinning regime.
Move as a function of
what? As a function of time.
What about trying to test the current?
You can try. So actually, I mean, there's a major field of vortex motion and flux studies, and like I said, they're actually having a conference this week in the Netherlands. There's a lot of work on vortex pinning and vortex motion, but most of it is not in the dilute single vortex regime. So we'd like to repeat these kinds of measurements in the dilute single vortex regime, and we could try to pass a current and move them. We tried to move it around by putting an electric field on our squid, putting a voltage on our squid to drive around with an electric field. And we know that vortices repel each other, right? So the reason why there's three vortices here is because there's a step in the surface there, and they're pinned on the step. We did topography measurements simultaneously. And so we tried to drive the vortices around by putting a magnetic field. I can tell you about that when I show you the susceptometer, but we tried to drive them around with a locally applied magnetic field. And we couldn't drive them around in the ortho 2 sample. So basically, we just did this for comparison because we have we hope to have some 5 Kelvin single crystal YBCO that we're also going to try to do these studies in. So we just did the ortho 2 to check that the vortices don't move there. Okay. We also have Hall probe microscopy, which is useful for making measurements as a function of temperature. And this is a measurement on a magnetic information storage media. These are images of the bits. And this is an image at 4 Kelvin. And those bits stay there all the way up to room temperature, which is nice, because you'd expect magnetic bits to do that. And this is a study of magnetic domains in a manganate sample. And these magnetic domains go away at 120 Kelvin, which is what you'd expect them to do. And we haven't yet looked at vortices to see them going away at 90 Kelvin.
What resolution do you have?
Right now we have 2 microns, and we're hoping to have quarter micron. Okay, so the third tool in our toolbox is squid susceptometry. So here we have a squid with a pickup loop, and then we have a field coil. And so this is the loop that we used. We passed a current through this loop that made a magnetic field of about 15 Gauss at the surface of the sample, and tried to use that to drive vortices around in the ortho 2 crystal. And we couldn't drive them around. So that was last week's
Karen, I'm sorry, back to your fall probe.
Yeah.
What sort of region can you conveniently cover with that?
We can scan a 70 micron region of the sample. And if there were a reason to do more, we can, this is with fine motion, we can do coarse motion over 2 millimeters. And if there were a really desperate reason to do more, we could go to IBM and use John Kirtley's microscope, which has a centimeter scan range. Okay, so this is our Squibsa septometer. And this is an image, this is what I wanted to say about being able to look for trace elements of granular superconductor. This is an image of a 3-micron disk of tin sitting on a non-superconducting substrate. And what you see here is that as we decrease the temperature, the disk of tin goes superconducting at 3.7 Kelvin, and then it continues to shield better and better as you go down to lower temperatures. And so this is a kind of study that we could use to search for little puddles of superconductor that could be somehow retaining the memory of the presence of the vortex. And actually, this is also kind of mildly interesting to me. I haven't really figured this out quantitatively yet, but so our unpatterned film had a transition width of less than 0.1 Kelvin when measured in an applied, so these measurements are made with an applied field of 0.1 Gauss, which is a pretty small applied field for measuring superconducting transitions in. And the single 3-micron dot has a much broader transition, and it's a broader transition that's much broader than what you'd expect from the plausible temperature dependence of the penetration depth of the tin. So I don't quite know why this transition is broader. There's probably some trivial reason that I just haven't thought of, so if you have any ideas for that. Okay, and then so we also like to make measurements on a smaller length scale, so we're trying to develop very high-resolution MFM. And this is just a proof of principle experiment that an undergraduate REU student did in my lab this summer. He took nanotubes and attached nanotubes to AFM cantilevers. And what we want to do is we want to do magnetic force microscopy measurements where the active volume of magnetic material is extremely small. So we want to use a 9-nanometer cobalt nanoparticle from Munji Buendi's group at MIT and just measure the force between that 9-nanometer cobalt nanoparticle and the superconductor down beneath it. And so in order to do that, we need to get that 9-nanometer cobalt nanoparticle close to the surface of the superconductor without bringing it in on a big old cantilever, which is going to have its own interaction with the superconducting surface. So Van, who's a junior chemistry major from NYU, worked out this recipe for attaching cobalt nanoparticles to multi-walled nanotube tips. And this is a TEM image of that. So it's going to be, you know, years before we have any MFM images from this, that this is what we're working towards for higher resolution MFM. And then related to that, we're doing a project on torque magnetometry. So here are some 100 micron cantilevers, and then here are some individual 9-nanometer cobalt particles. Here's a clump of 2 9-nanometer cobalt particles sitting on one of those cantilevers. And then this is the resonant frequency of that cantilever as a function of magnetic field, showing the effect of the cobalt particles on the resonant frequency of the cantilever. So this might be something, I don't know, I haven't got any really brilliant ideas yet. I mean, we're mostly developing this system for studying nanomagnets, and I haven't got any brilliant ideas for what to do with it for superconductors, but there are people who are doing torque magnetometry on superconductors, and it might be that high field, flux quantization, the high field regime is interesting. There might be something that we could try to think of to do there. Okay. So I hope that I've convinced you that with good samples in the under-doped regime, which I think that you will see better results in terms of sample quality in the under-doped regime from the UBC group and from the Urbana group coming out in the pretty near future. And I hope that I've shown you that with samples of that quality, the array of tools for making magnetic measurements that's available now means that we should be able to do a pretty thorough job of studying flux quantization and single vortex pinning and single vortex hysteresis as a function of temperature issues in the under-doped groupings. And so if you have any particular ideas of things that you'd like us to look for, please let me know. So this is what we want to address experimentally, and I think the theoretical question that it would be nice to have a consensus answer to is how general is the class of models that can be tested by the central experiment and by all the possible related experiments. And just sort of a random poll suggests that there is not, in fact, a consensus on this issue. And I decided not to put up quotes because if I did, nobody would ever talk to me anymore.
or each other, right?
Doug Bond wanted me to ask, which mechanisms, if any, will definitely be ruled out by a positive result on the central experiment? And so I don't want to push anybody into making statements on that, because I think there's a growing cultural awareness of the value of making experimental predictions, which is good, but we don't want to go too far in that direction either. We don't want to push people into making predictions just because it's cool. But nevertheless, wrong predictions are very cool. Actually, I think there should be an award for clean I think there should really be a reward for clean, sharp, theoretical predictions that are demonstrated experimentally incorrect in particular material systems.
Nice.
I would. It's equally difficult to do a really correct theory, whether it's applicable to the particular materials you hoped it was applicable to or not. So I don't see why one has more social value than the other. But anyway, so Doug Bond wants me to ask this question and come back with a good answer by the end of the week. And
the even other effect is pretty clear. I mean, it's probably measuring anything that's whatever. There will have effect.
Okay, great.
I think that's
can you just speak into the mic here?
Can you say that?
The even other effect, I think, is very clear. You see that mechanism. It's hard to imagine any other mechanism that's going to happen.
If you see
that,
so you would say that most other theories are coming up.
By a positive result.
Yeah.
Okay. So I just want to close by making sure that my collaborators are properly acknowledged, especially John Kirtley at IBM and Brian Gardner and Janice Nguyen at Stanford, who will be making the measurements that I've talked about making. And Doug Bond and his collaborators at UBC, who are making very nice progress in the underdoped state of YBCS single crystals. And also to thank the people who have provided us with samples for the interlayer justice and vortex studies that I showed you. Okay, so thanks a lot. Got all the questions during the talk, right? Is anybody holding anything back?
Well, what is this group in Japan, like Katrina, who seems to be making capital samples for everything else? Can they make samples of comparable quality? Will they come there?
So, I asked. So far, I've focused my search on YBCO and DISCO, and I asked Isaki, who's from Uchida's group originally, about that, and he said that they had this issue with the 50 Kelvin DISCO just breaking away.